This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Good evening, one and all, and welcome to Teachers Talk Radio for the Twilight Show with me, Adam Colbert. Tonight, I'm joined by a head teacher who is 2 years into the job to talk about making the transition from deputy up to head. Swabra Lloyd is here to answer your questions, and nothing is off limits. So tune in, call in, text in, and talk it out.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
So who would be a head teacher? Why would anybody want to go into the fireplace that is headship? So I'm fairly well positioned to talk about this, I think, because my school have had 5 head teachers in the last 2 years. And that includes me and my little 3-month stint as acting head. And so over that time, I've seen a few head teachers come and go, and I've spoken to all of them about exactly what it is that motivated them to move from deputy headship into headship. And they've talked to me a lot about all of the things they love about the job, but also all of the challenges to do with the job as well. And I must say that over the course of that period, it has made me stop and question my kind of natural ambition in myself to one day become a head, because there are so many unseen challenges to it that you only realize when you are in that chair. And certainly that was something that I found in my 3-month stint as acting head, that there were things that I'd just never ever considered that suddenly I had to have a really, really good understanding of. Things like budget and premises and all of those kinds of things. I remember vividly last February half term drilling coat pegs into the wall because it just needed to be done, and our premises manager was off sick at the time. And those are the things that you don't ever think that you're going to be doing when you go into education. And even I would think when you go into headship, those aren't the things that you anticipate doing. But ultimately, if things need to be done, it sits with the head teacher. The final fall will always be with the head. So why would anybody want to do that? That's even without taking into account the context at the moment around Ofsted and the high accountability measures that they have. And we know, of course, that lots of head teachers are finding that really challenging. And even with Ofsted's Big Listen and everything else out there at the moment around trying to kind of correct the way that things are in that particular part of our sector, there are still massive pressures and challenges from external challenges that make the job of a head teacher really, really difficult and really challenging. The massive accountability doesn't just come from Ofsted as well. It comes from other external agencies and partners like parents, the local community. So there are a raft of challenges, but still it's a job that is desirable to lots of people. It's still a job that offers the opportunity to make a wide impact on an entire community that few other jobs have the potential to give you. And that ultimately is why a lot of people still do go into it. But as I say, it's an environment that when you do step into it, you're often dealing with things that you never expected that you would have to be dealing with. Another is the governors as well. So as a deputy head, you're kind of shielded from the governors a lot of the time by your head teacher. When you become the head, you are thrust into that environment where you have to be managing people who are ultimately above you in the hierarchy of the organization, but they aren't teaching people, they aren't education experts. And often it's quite difficult to be in that situation where you're having to show somebody that isn't an expert how to challenge you in an area that you have expertise in. So again, it's an area that is fraught with challenge and is a really difficult one to navigate. But nonetheless, it is one that if you get right and you really, really can get into it and get settled into it, it's a job that's hugely rewarding and can be incredibly enjoyable. And I think that's the core message that we're going to get from our guest tonight. So without any further ado, I will bring in Swabra. Swabra, can you hear us?
Yes, I can, Adam. Hello, good evening.
That is a relief. It's always a bit of a relief when someone says that they can actually hear me and I'm not just going to be talking to myself for an hour and a half.
Likewise, I was hoping I'd get in on no problems, and it was smooth sailing so far.
Well, you're an awful lot better at technology than I am. And for anybody that's listening along, the context of Swabra and I is that when Swabra did actually take the jump into headship, she freed up her deputy headship at the school that she was at previously, and I filled that gap. So it's a void that I have completely failed to fill on a technological standpoint. I can tell you there are still lots of staff that on a daily basis lament the fact that Swabra isn't there to sort out all the technological issues, because I just can't do it. But so yeah, you've definitely left that legacy at the school, that's for sure.
I'm pleased to hear. I think I'll probably leave that everywhere I go. I was up a ladder earlier this morning, Adam, fixing the projector in the hall.
Up ladders, managing governors, it's just another thing that you don't expect to be doing when you become a head teacher. But if you were up a ladder, I'm sure you'd have done it with absolutely perfect health and safety and all absolutely. Of the relevant risk assessments in place, and no one would be up that ladder better than you, I'm sure.
Most definitely. I've done all my training and I was woman for the job. Wouldn't let any of my other staff get up the ladder because they didn't have the training, but I did.
Wow, there you go. You see, there you go. You've got to have the training in place for sure. So before we get into the conversation around why you chose to be a head teacher and exactly what the pitfalls of the job are, but also what the joys of the job are, can you just give us a bit of a background on you? What's your story? I've obviously introduced a little bit about the fact that you used to work at the school that I now currently work at, but what's your journey been from beginning to where you are now?
I've been in education for 18 years. In fact, I was thinking I've never given up my pencil case since I started school at the age of 3. But I've not had the traditional route into primary education. In fact, when I finished my degree in English, I taught English as a foreign language in ESOL at a private college in London. Then I went off to work with offenders, believe it or not. And I taught in offender learning for a number of years, and it was there I kind of thought something's gone terribly wrong in our education system if I was find myself teaching grown men phonics, and it was heartbreaking. I thought, how have you left school without the ability to read? So from then on I went on to a further education college to work with what they refer to as NEETs, not in education training or employment. And I still felt this kind of urge to go back to, the very, very early days of education, people's career kind of starting point, coming back to, again, looking at the teenagers I was working without the basic grasp of the fundamentals of, reading and writing. So I joined Teach First and jumped into a teaching post. Having taught for 6 years, but not having a PGCE. So I started Teach First with, 6 years under my belt of teaching experience, teaching adults and teenagers. And it's from then on that I found my love and my passion in primary education. And I've worked for 3 local authorities. I started teaching in London Borough of Croydon. I'm now back in the London Borough of Croydon, having worked in the boroughs of Bromley, Bexley. And yeah, I'm back in Croydon again.
So there's something very circle of life about that.
Yes, it really, really is. It felt like coming home, actually. Quite a lot of people in the local authorities are still the ones that were there, a decade earlier when I was first there. So it's kind of, it's been great. But what I'm really passionate about is that social mobility that education offers, that lifeline for social mobility and those, fundamental life skills from an early age.
And I think that's really key. And obviously where you've kind of had your formative years in an environment where you've seen what happens if that isn't in place, I guess that's kind of shaped that ethos that you've got. And I always remember being at a conference a couple of years ago and listening to one of the speakers. I can never remember the name of the speaker, and I've never been able to find her name afterwards as well. I've always really, really annoys me because it was a brilliant talk. And she was talking about a program that she developed around developing a sense of citizenship and community and responsibility in young people. And she said that she realized that she needed to do that because in a previous working life, she was a journalist, and she'd been out to India and she'd gone to interview some people who had been convicted of the most horrendous, heinous crimes. And she said that when she went in to do the interview, she was expecting to kind of find just, you know, these absolute monsters of people and just, you know, the worst of the worst of the worst. But she said that actually what she found was just perfectly normal people who just had an incredibly warped view of how the world worked and where they kind of sat within the world. And she said that it was so clear to her that that was because of education or a lack of education. And she said that it made her realize that actually it's when you're in education, it's not just about the impact that you have on that one person. It's about the impact that that one person then goes on to have for the rest of society. So yeah, I mean, what you were saying there about your roots and where you started from kind of took me back to that quite clearly. And I think it's a brilliant reason to be in the profession. And I guess it continues to guide you to this day, does it?
It really does. I think of some of the my early days of teaching and working with adults, and one particular guy who came to me and said, "I was able to read to my son tonight, you know, yesterday," and that's really always remained with me when I think about, like you said, the children, not, you know, now, but, you know, 10, 20, 30 years from now, and where that's going to take them. I generally believe in that, you know, that social mobility. To me, having high kind of aspirations for our kids, is that no door is shut. Whether they choose to walk through that door is entirely up to them. But any door they want to walk through, whether it's to doing the GCSEs or A-levels or university, it's the choice that they are able to make. But they need those fundamentals.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that having kind of worked with so many head teachers over the last couple of years, is that what really stands out is that each and every one of them have got a really, really clear ethos that they bring to the job. And so often that isn't rooted necessarily in education. It's rooted in community or society. It's rooted really in the things that education goes on to influence and shape. And I think that's a really, really important thing. If you're going to go into headship, it's not about reading, writing and maths alone. It is about the community that you're helping shape and the young people that will go on to lead that community, be it a local community or a wider community, and even up to like an international community. And so what has to drive you, I think, at the heart of it has to be, what do you want for society? Our ethos at my school now is to continually strive for social justice and equity of opportunity. And when we were kind of coming up with that, when we sort of rebranded it, a lot of that actually came from some of the conversations that we'd had actually when you were handing over to me about the context of the school. And, you know, historically where the school sits, the political background of that isn't the most diverse. And so it was something that we decided we really needed to tap into, to try and enhance, to make sure that the children that come to our school get that experience of that ethos, of a really inclusive ethos, and one that celebrates diversity that perhaps wasn't there as much in the past. So, yeah, I'm really interested by that idea of making sure that you're clear on really what drives you. How does that filter through to, just give us like one example of an area of school life that people might often think of as being sort of divorced from these big thinking things like ethos and values and vision? Can you give us one example of how that really strong ethos translates into those contexts?
Yeah, I can. So just thinking in terms of, for example, attendance, you're thinking, what's, you know, the ethos of that? It's shaping children's lives. It's ensuring that actually that they are those routines, that the, you know, timetables and everything that we do in life, we have to be present for. So it starts off with the kids just being school in time. And our, you know, our values and our ethos, in terms of working with parents, we like in this school, we've got children who have persistent absences. We've got, you know, parents who don't value education as much, and that kind of building those relationships, and that really rooted in our ethos on working with all parents, be it parents who haven't got, you know, English as a first language, fellow parents who've had very, very different difficult education pathways themselves, and kind of are wary of professionals. It's really, really critical that they see us as, you know, how strong our values are and how that's driving everything that we do in school. And it also underpins the relationships that we build. Yes, I am the head, but I have such great strength in my team, And we really play off each other in terms of who's the best person to have these conversations. It's not necessarily always me. It's not always necessarily our attendance officer. And we look at, you know, who's built those relationships based on these values that we have with parents. And it works wonders to a point that we're now an attendance hub for the DfE, supporting 65 schools nationally. So we must be getting something right.
Yeah, I'm sure you're getting more than just something right, knowing you, that's for sure. But I think that's fantastic as well, the idea that actually having a really clear ethos that everything else almost bleeds from, that can really help build those trusting relationships as well with everybody, with the community, but also with staff as well. Because I think when staff see that everything that you're doing comes from that central belief and that ethos, they start to see that you're authentic. And I think that's the thing that people, I think, in schools look for the most. It's certainly the thing that I look for the most, is I can kind of feel like I can get on board with most ethoses and most sort of ways of working and visions, but only if it's authentic. And I think when everything so clearly comes back to what your personal ethos is, I think that makes it much easier for people to see you as authentic and therefore to get on board. We've got loads and loads of questions that people want to put to you. I put out on social media this week, just asking for people to pose questions that they'd want to ask of someone that fairly recently took the plunge into headship. And we'll come to those in a moment. But before we do, we're just going to break just to have a few messages from our friends and sponsors.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support head teachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
Okay, welcome back. So before we dive into these questions, let's set the scene a little bit. So most people will know that the DfE recently announced a review into the funding setup for the National Professional Qualification suite that they've got. And interestingly, amongst all of the kind of funding cuts that they made on those courses, the NPQH was sacred. So the National Professional Qualification in Headship is still fully funded across the country. So that what that sort of suggests is firstly that perhaps the DfE are aware that they need to make sure that when head teachers do go into post, that they've got the training and they've got the knowledge that they need to succeed in it. But what that suggests, I think, is that there are clear differences between being a deputy head and being a head teacher, and that making that transition isn't easy. And it's not a case of just being like a giant teacher. Being a head teacher has a very specific skill set and a very specific set of a very specific knowledge base that you have in order to go into it and be a success at it. And I would even go as far as to say that roles like acting head and interim head aren't on their own anyway good enough to prepare you to go in and become the head teacher. So again, in my current school, I was acting head for 3 months and applied for the substantive headship as well, and was unsuccessful. I didn't get the job. And looking back on that now, I can absolutely see, having worked with my new head teacher for 2 or 3 weeks now, I can absolutely see that was absolutely the right thing to do. It was the right decision for the school to make, because she is far more ready to take on that role than what I was. And I think a lot of that comes down to the fact that when you're acting head, or when I was acting head anyway, it was in a time of kind of turmoil for the school. There was a lot of there'd been a lot of change that had happened over a short period of time, and there was a lot of things that kind of needed fixing quite fast. And I was quite good in that environment, in that kind of firefighting environment, and I was quite strategic around things like teaching and learning. And you know, our results at the end of last year showed that, you know, our outcomes put us in the top 1% of schools in the country. So while my role as acting head allowed me to kind of keep everything else sort of ticking over around health and safety and all of that kind of stuff, and just make sure that everything was compliant, and then throw myself fully really into teaching and learning and make sure that was the thing that was really well protected. Other areas of the school, the kind of longer term parts of the school, where, you know, things like building relationships with parents and with the community and that kind of stuff, that wasn't an area that I had enough experience in to really get to grips with. So I think that it's definitely true to say, and definitely important to acknowledge, that being a head teacher has a really specific skill set, and it's something that you've got to be absolutely convinced that you've nailed, I think, before you take that plunge. By nailed, I don't mean that you're absolutely brilliant at all of it, but that you've got an understanding of how broad and varied the role is, so that you're prepared for what you're about to step into as far as you ever can be when you go into headship. So Swabra, taking all of that into account, what is the biggest single difference between being a head and a deputy?
Adam, you touched upon quite a lot of that. But the biggest difference is the scope, the absolute scope of the shift in responsibility. Obviously, accountability goes without say, but it is keeping all those plates spinning. It is your responsibility. You've got, you know, end of the day, you've got the final say, and you know, ultimately, obviously, everything from the finance to HR to premises to health and safety. I've become quite an asbestos expert recently, GDPR. But I guess for me as well, it's as a deputy, you are supporting the head teachers to implement their vision. And when you are the head, you are responsible for shaping and driving that vision, and bringing the team along with you and making those strategic decisions that is leading the entire school community towards your goals and towards your vision. And I remember part of my interview, I was asked, to present what my 3-year vision would be for the school. And I'm 2 years in, and that is still my vision. And we've made some good progress towards it. But even from the point where I was interviewed, my vision hasn't shifted, and my team know what it is, and they know, coming along with me, and we know we are well on our way towards that journey.
Yeah, and that's fascinating as well. I think the fact that you are, that point you made there about the fact that when you're a deputy, you're supporting the vision, when you're a head teacher, you're setting the vision. And again, if I just draw the parallel to my experience of headship, which was acting headship, my sort of remit there was like, right, get everybody together, make sure that every kid is A, safe, and B, getting good lessons day in, day out. But it was very much, it was almost one of those kind of siege mentality type scenarios where it's like, right, guys, over the short term, between now and the end of this year, or between now and the end of this term, this is what we're going to work towards together. We're all going to chip into it. And we sort of developed this sort of camaraderie quite quickly, that even as we were kind of doing that, I did start to wonder how sustainable that was, because ultimately we were asking things of people that they were happy to give, but I'm not sure how kind of sustainable it would be. And I think what you've hit on there is this idea that when you're the head teacher, your job is to set that vision, but also to set the pace towards that vision. And that's that there's real skill involved in that.
Absolutely. And it's also just, not only is it that pace, is making sure that, you know, what are your core priorities? And these core priorities are, you know, we come up with, you know, 3 or 4 core priorities every year, but my staff can clearly see a thread from one year to another. So we're not shifting and changing, like we are on this trajectory. And this core priority, this tweaking of the wording, but really ultimately it's still the same thing, because we're striving towards, you know, this point in our journey. And I guess where I got lucky, I would recommend, you know, if possible, for all head teachers, is to start a headship in the summer term. Yeah. As you know, you know, I left the post that you have now in April, and you know, took on the headship in April, and it just meant that I had the breathing space and the time to get to know the school. I inherited an SDP, a school development plan, for that academic year. So I was reviewing what did we achieve in the autumn? What did we achieve in the spring? But it also meant that I could put a really tight action plan based on the SDP that I'd inherited for the summer term quite tightly. And then it meant that I knew the school well enough to write a school development plan and set my vision in from that September.
So it's almost like a self-run induction.
Exactly. Honestly, I got lucky. It was, you know, it just happened to, you know, that's how it felt. Obviously, this is my first headship. But honestly, looking back, that was brilliant. That was absolutely the best thing that could have happened to me and the school, to be honest.
And it's interesting as well, because that we have, so at Birkbeck, where you used to work and I work now, so our new head teacher, she also started at the beginning of the summer term as well. And I think she's getting it right, but I think it's really easy to get it wrong with starting there as well, because you kind of go in just as the weather's getting nice and, you know, you've got all of the energy and it's a new job. And it's really, I think it would be really easy to kind of come into that kind of situation and go, right, this is going to change and this is going to change. We're going to do this really quickly. And because you've got the energy and all of that enthusiasm. And as I say, the weather's changing and it's making everybody kind of feel a little bit more positive about things as well. But certainly something that, that our new head teacher said when she started was that her brief to start with was going to be to watch and listen and understand. And she was really clear that, you know, anything where it was health and safety or safeguarding, she changed straight away. But everything else, she was going to spend time watching, listening, talking to people to understand how things work and the rationale behind those things and what the principles behind why those things are the way that they are. And that's something that I really like, the idea of this concept of trying to get to the root of what the principles were behind the decisions that have been made, so that you're not just changing things when you do change things. You're not just changing them on a surface level, but you're changing them at that more strategic, principle-based level as well. Because if you do that, then people are going to start to change other things as well, because they'll see and they'll change them off their own backs, because they'll see what your principles are, what your ethos is. It comes back to that ethos again, doesn't it? They'll start to sense what that is and then start to make other changes around the school that will align with that. I think it's a really, really intelligent thing
absolutely.
To do.
Absolutely. And then one thing that I did exactly what your current head is doing is just, you know, listen, watch, be visible, walk around the school, walk around every break time, every lunch time, talk to the children. And then I also met one-to-one with every member of staff. And it's really critical, yeah. Again, coming back to those relationships, building those relationships. But fundamentally also asking them, the one thing that I shouldn't touch about Forest Academy. Like, Swarborough, if you do everything, anything, do not touch
this thing.
It just works beautifully. So I knew, I've asked him the one thing to change, it was working well. But just by meeting a member of staff from the premises team to my office team and every teaching assistant, I really got to understand and I could see the threads as well.
Mm. Yeah, so you get to see those commonalities.
Absolutely.
And kind of test out because I guess you kind of formulate this hypothesis about, right, what do I think is working well in this school? And I guess you start to formulate that even before you get there. But then when you're in there, you really start to formulate it. And then you're almost testing that hypothesis out by looking for those commonalities. I mean, it sounds like you and the current head teacher at Birkbeck have like read the same head teacher playbook, because it's really similar. The whole meeting one-to-one with every member of staff, which again, I love. But I love this idea of like, right, what's the one thing I shouldn't change? Like, what's the thing that's really, really working well? So that's really interesting stuff. One of the questions that we had come in, which I think was a really interesting one, was like, what did you actually do on day one? And looking back on it, would you change that? It's something that, you know, when I think about potentially going into headship, or even, to be honest, any kind of leadership role in a new school, it's always something that kind of is a bit like the unknown. Like, what am I actually going to do when I walk through the door? Like, do I go to the office? Do I go to classrooms? Do I go and make tea? What is it that I actually do when I walk through that door? So what did you do on day one, and would you change it now?
Can I just take it back a little bit? What I did do on day T-7.
Yes. I love this adaptability.
and then I'll get to day one. What I did is I went in over the Easter holidays, and I cleaned my office. I made some very tiny minor changes. At the time, I was going to share an office with a member of staff who I was an associate head. Sort of my deputy, but she was off on long-term sick. So I was really respectful to her space and didn't touch anything that was hers. But I wanted to make a subtle change that, hey guys, this is a change in leadership here. And I'm only my new person, I'm going to do things differently. So I changed the environment ever so slightly. I changed my desk. I put the display outside the office. Just a really subtle hint that she's going to do things differently. Don't expect, you know, what was there before. And that was a very, very conscious decision to do that.
Yeah, I love that.
And then day one, I got in nice and early. I walked around the building multiple times, greeted everyone, just stopped, got their names, you know, because I'd met people, but obviously in the interviews or when you look around, you can't take it all in. And I'd had some kind of handover days of the previous head. So, you know, when I came in, obviously, I knew my office team. And, you know, I offered to make them a drink. Happy office, happy school, honestly. They are the front of the school. They are they're the eyes and the ears. They are just, honestly, I think sometimes they're underestimated, you know. And I hope my team is listening. So offer them to make a drink. And just got to know them, visible on the gate, greeting parents. Again, they had seen me there before when I had attended for the handover days. I made sure I was on the gate with the interim head, so the parents knew how I was. Morning there. Walked into every classroom after the kids are settled in just to say good morning again, show my face. Did an assembly. And I don't think I sat very much in my office that day. I was just everywhere. And I said to people, I'm going to be around. Like, please don't be, you know, nervous of me. I'm just learning for us. I'm learning about us. I'm going to have 101 questions. Mm. And that's what I did. I asked sometimes what would be the most ridiculous questions. But I said, just bear with me. I'm going to ask you 1,000,001 questions. Like, where's this? Where's that? How do I do this? and I think that just got people to kind of relax a little bit on that first day and first week. But oh, okay, you know, she's not coming across as a know-it-all. She's just, you know, wanting to listen.
That's such a great point, that bit there, because Chris has just sent a question on the chat. So first of all, this is really inspirational to hear. And I know actually that Chris is someone that is potentially looking at taking on a headship in the not too distant future as well. So it's great that you're inspiring someone like him as well with this. But he said, how important is it to A, be your authentic self as a head teacher, but also to embrace vulnerability? And I think you kind of just touched on that there. So yeah, how important is it to embrace not knowing stuff and embrace vulnerability?
Hugely important, really hugely important. I guess my personality, but in the words of Brené Brown, you know, vulnerability is a superpower. And sometimes, you know, we can forget that. Mm. And I am honestly 100% my authentic self. My staff see me as me, music in my office in the morning, walking around when my heels have been taken off because, you know, my feet are tired at the end of the day, or sitting often in meetings with my legs crossed, you know, these tiny little things, because I can't be anyone else. I am me. And because I'm so authentically myself, I think like they can be themselves too. Yeah. And what that's created is, you know, we work in a challenging community. We've got 67% pupil premium, which is just on paper. In reality, probably around 80% pupil premium. In a whole huge context, that's, you know, quite challenging. But it's a happy school and we laugh quite a lot because we are all able to be authentic self. Often staff go off, you know, to courses and to training and to other schools, and they come back and we all say, oh, it's so good to be home. It's our home away from home. It doesn't mean that, you know, we don't challenge each other. We do. We have those challenging conversations. But we know that they come from a place of deep care, and it's not personal. And that's because of being able to be our authentic selves and being able to build those relationships that we can then actually have really challenging conversations and loggerheads, but in a respectful way where you walk away and you're still, you know, smiling and, you know, having a laugh, but knowing that actually, you know, this, you know, we've had a serious, you know, serious conversation. And I always welcome staff to challenge me. And I say, do you know what? I've had this idea, but go think about it. Think about ways, you know, what could possibly go wrong? How could you challenge us? And then come back. I'm not putting you on the spot.
Mm. Oh, I love that idea of the pre-mortem that you touched on, for sure. I think that's, I mean, and knowing you as well, one of the first conversations that we had, so when we sat in your office, that's now my office, our office, let's call it. And
I love that office.
Yeah, it's a lovely office. Chairs.
Yeah.
I mean, this will mean nothing to anyone that's listening, but there are
a
couple of...
It's yellow, it's bright, it's beautiful, it's got a great view for those who don't know.
If the job ever comes up, go for it, because it's a great office. But I remember us having a conversation about some of the books that you had on the bookshelf as well. And you went straight for, you were like, ethics of excellence. Like, this is what I stand for. So I know, and from other conversations that we've had as well, I know that you are all about absolute highest of high standards. Like, you do not suffer anything less. So how do you marry that and that continual drive to constantly be challenging yourself and challenging everybody else, alongside creating that kind of psychological safety that's so important to actually get development happening? Like, how do you do that?
It's clarity of vision and expectations, because for some things, being a 1 degree difference from, you know, myself or my deputy or my, you know, my SLT isn't a big deal. But in other things, 1% is too big a deal in terms of our differences of approach. So it's having those really, really, really clear expectations. I mean, prime example, walking around the building. We walk, we expect children to transition in silence. But yeah. Why? So it's understood for every member of staff, plus also the children, to understand the why. Okay, we've just had play times, as we know, we're a Nurture UK school. So it's talking about, you know, if your brain's like a glitter jar and it's been shaken, that, you know, that transitions are so important. These micro transitions are so important. We're working on our breathing, we're calming down, we're respecting the people who are working around us. We're, you know, where staff stand in terms of, so they can see, they don't just stand in front of the line and, you know, with their backs to the line. So it's by being really, really clear on the expectations. But also, you talked about, you know, we talked about pace earlier, working up, what do I need to do now? What can wait? Because you can't do everything and you can't drive everyone so hard at everything all the time. So you have to kind of pick, okay, what am I going to work on? What's it going to go on to next? How I'm going to, you know, get this plate spinning and keep it spinning when I move on to something else. So being strategic about what you're going to do it and when.
I love that as well. And I don't know if it was deliberate, but you said there is a, you can't drive everyone at the same time. Are there times when you are really focused on one particular team or one particular pocket of the school? Yes. You're thinking, right, I'm going to let these ones tick over for the time being. But my real development time at the moment is going to be devoted to these people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And like I said, it's being strategic as to where in their journey they are. And also, in terms of, I strongly believe about system in systems, we're custodians of schools and for a short period of time. We're temporary custodians of schools. Yeah. So therefore, what systems are we going to put in place that are right for the community, that are right for the children, that are right for the staff? So therefore, I work in thinking, okay, so in terms of succession planning, I don't have a plan to go anywhere. But I've got to think about my team coming up. And I think, you know, just God forbid something happened to me, then the school shouldn't fall apart. You know, children's lives are, you know, education is far too important to be dependent, you know, on the head. So systems. So thinking about how I'm supporting and working on with my deputy head or my wider SLT in sharing my work with them. So like, for example, submitting data to the local authority. This year, I'm not doing it. My assistant head is doing it. So every time, different times of the year, shifting my focus on who needs it. Or, you know, what's going on in the school life and the school diary, that, you know, that needs it. I've got a new maths lead. She's really, really passionate, but just needs a support in really understanding that whole school wide data. So working with her.
I mean, that what you just said in there was absolute gold around this idea of needing to shift your focus onto different areas at different times to make sure that everybody's getting what they need. But the bit that I absolutely loved there was this idea of head teachers being custodians of schools and kind of having a responsibility to make sure that you look after and nurture that community, everything that that community stands for, everything that community needs and deserves, so that it's almost ready to hand over to the next person. And just in case, like the CEO of your trust is listening, Swabra did say she has no plans to go anywhere, which is just want to make that really clear. But it's like, that is a lovely way of looking at it, that actually you're a custodian of the school and of the community that it serves. I think that's absolutely fantastic. Another question that came in, which I thought was fantastic, is, so what was it that made you feel ready to take on headship? Like, was it that you just woke up one morning and was like, yeah, I'm going for it? Did you just get fed up with someone else telling you what to do and thought, I'm going to go and do it myself? Like, what was it that made you think, yeah, I think I know enough to give this a crack now?
I guess I had good CPD, really, really good CPD. I didn't do the, I know you mentioned the MPQH earlier. I didn't do the MPQH, but I do have a master's in educational leadership from UCL, which covers quite a lot and probably a little bit more than the MPQH.
Definitely.
So, you know, and reading, I read widely as well. You know, I still do read really, really widely. But it was, do you know what? I found myself going, oh, do you know what? In meetings again, I would do that slightly differently. Oh, I would do that. But of course, you know, and you'd have challenging conversations with the head, but in front of your school, in front of your staff, you would support the head teacher. But in my head, I'm like, I would do this slightly differently. So I kept doing more and more of that.
Yeah.
And you mentioned there's been, you know, 5 heads in 2 years. And I was, and did you, I think, yeah, so just that's just kind of the overlap time kind of when I left as well. And there was an interim head who came in called Rob, and I know I love him dearly and we still keep in touch till today. And he said to me, why am I doing here? You know, as in he, why was he there? He's like, you can do this. Like, and it just, I guess it took him to give me that final push to apply, but I knew it had to be the right school.
Yeah,
I
for sure.
I wanted headship, but it had to be, and I work for Inspire Partnership, and I'd been kind of stalking Inspire since 2017, and I visited, you know, a couple of schools who were, you know, looking for heads, and I only applied for the Inspire one, because when I visited the other schools, they didn't feel right for me. And when I visited Inspire, and I met Rob, and I'd met Rob previously years ago, just at a conference, it felt like it was the right fit, and it genuinely is the right fit. I mean, I absolutely love, you know, love working at Forest.
I think that's what you touched on there. You said that, you know, when Rob, the head teacher at the time at Birkbeck, said, what am I doing here? You can do this. That's something I think that I've said a few times to different people when they've asked me about headship. And I've always said, well, when someone that's good at it and has done it really well and knows it inside out says to me, you should do this now because you can, that's probably when I'll go for it. And so far, like, every head teacher that I've worked with has been really, really lovely, and they've kind of you know, they've praised, and been really open and honest here, like they've praised lots of different parts of my work, particularly the stuff around professional development and curriculum design, but none of them have ever said to me outright, you should go and be a head now, you're ready. And I don't mean that I don't say that because I'm not saying that they haven't encouraged me enough. They absolutely have. Like, but I do think that it's such an important job and it's such an important step that until somebody that's done it and knows it says, yeah, you're ready for this now, like you've got this, I think it's, for me, I don't think I will go for it until someone does say that to me.
And I agree with you in terms of, like, there's always that element of self-doubt, because obviously it's such a huge area of responsibility, you know, it's such a huge role in the accountability. Like I said, he's, you know, those who know him, has been kind of the reputation of going into schools, failing schools. I mean, Birkbeck wasn't failing, but previously turning them around into good offs, you know, failing into, you know, good Ofsted outcomes, and just turning schools around in quite a short period of time. He'd done that over and over again. I think this was his like 13th headship. So when he came and told me that, I was like, whoa, this must mean something.
Wow. 13.
Yeah.
God, yeah. If you keep getting asked back after that.
Robert's listening, let me know.
Yeah. that is quite something. I'm going to give you this question just to think on, just while we go to the news. So the curriculum consultant has just written in and has just said, so do you miss being in the classroom and do you still have a teaching timetable? So I'll let you think on that question while we go to the news.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by Teach Well Toolkit as a handbook to support head teachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
Multiple media outlets have covered comments made by UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak about pro-Palestinian demonstrations which are taking place on university campuses nationwide. Mr. Sunak called on university leaders to ensure the safety of all students and highlighted the importance of universities as places where respectful debate flourishes, but called them bastions of tolerance. He went on to criticise a vocal minority who were disrupting the lives and studies of their fellow students. He also said that there were some cases of outright harassment that has to stop. The meeting with the university leaders aimed to address the response of higher education institutions to the surge in pro-Palestinian protests, as encampments have appeared on more than a dozen campuses. Education Secretary Gillian Keegan has said that university vice-chancellors need to show leadership over concerns that campuses could become unsafe environments if they go down the route that you see in other places like the US. In recent weeks, TV footage has shown police in the United States break up demonstrations and encampments at universities and colleges across that country. Many images show officers in riot gear and in large numbers. In Scotland, new First Minister John Swinney has been accused of using the same old excuses as he refused to answer a question about whether he would live up to a promise made by the SNP to add an extra 3,500 teachers to the workforce. The Scottish Daily Express reports that Mr. Swinney was accused of having a record in education of broken promises. The comments were made by Scottish Tory leader Douglas Ross, and Mr. Ross went on to highlight cuts to teacher jobs by cash-strapped councils, failing to provide a laptop to every child, and abandoning a bill intended to raise standards. Mr. Swinney served as Education Minister from 2016 to 2021. In England, Education Secretary Gillian Keegan has also been on record about the impact parents working from home has had on school attendance. Speaking to The Times, Ms. Keegan said that 50,000 more school pupils took absences on Fridays compared to the start of the week, and cited working from home parents who whisk their children out of school on Friday to take them off for long weekend breaks. Ms. Keegan said curbing the rise in absences was a top priority, and that data has helped target support for parents and schools. Fines which can be issued to parents have increased from a minimum of £20 to a minimum of £80. The BBC reports that students hoping to start undergraduate courses in 2025 will be able to see the grades that recent successful applicants have achieved at A level or the equivalent. Universities already publish entry requirements for courses, but they can be flexible and let students in with lower grades. UCAS is making the changes to help students make informed, ambitious choices and to give them confidence in their applications. Applications for undergrad courses for 2025 open on the 14th of May. The new tool should allow students to search a course and see the most recent common grades held by those accepted onto it in previous years. It will also show how many students were offered a place compared with those who applied. Students who get free school meals will also no longer have to pay the £28.50 application fee. Finally, international students in Wales are reported by the BBC as sleeping rough on some university campuses after struggling to find housing close to lectures. A long commute from affordable accommodation has seen some students sleep in 24-hour study spaces to help reduce costs. Universities Wales says it always encourages students facing difficulty to talk to their institution. Nida Ambreen of Bangor University Students' Union said postgrad international students were particularly affected as they often come with families and were not eligible for university housing. According to latest figures, there are 20,920 non-EU international students currently studying in Wales, and the Welsh universities are aiming to increase that number as they can be charged higher fees. Members of the Welsh Senedd have raised the issues repeatedly over the last year, but full details of this story can be found on the BBC News Wales website. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio News with Jo Fox.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for that, Joe. Some really interesting things going on in the news at the moment around education. It does feel like a time of real change where I know obviously there's everything going on at the moment around Ofsted's Big Listen and the potential removal of single word judgments, or at least displaying the single word judgments of all of the areas of the inspection on the Ofsted website as part of the publication of reports. But again, there are lots of other areas as well where it does feel like change is certainly afoot. And with some of the mentioning of attendance in there being a big focus for Gillian Keegan, I think she should probably talk to Swarbrick about being the attendance hub and about some of the work that you've done at Forest Academy to raise the attendance there. So Swarbrick, do you miss being in the classroom, and do you have a teaching timetable still?
I do miss being in the classroom. No, I don't have a teaching timetable. I'm not long out of the classroom. So as a deputy at Birkbeck, I did start there with a job sharing, a year five class in the first year that was there. But I do keep my finger on my toe, shall I say, in the classroom in terms of where possible taking year six booster classes. You know, it's that important week for our year six children this week. But also,
yes, it is.
So I was in the classroom this morning, but also just working quite closely with the way we plan at Inspire is we plan with nine schools in total, and we work in hubs just because geographically we're located. There's three schools in Croydon, three in Greenwich, and three in Medway. The three Croydon schools plan together, so we release all our release our teachers for a day. And they write the medium term plan. So as a senior leaders, we go in and we quality assure that medium term planning. We have those conversations. We also senior leaders lead those moderations, have those conversations. So even though I'm not in the classroom, I'm very much know what's going on in the classroom. But yeah, I do miss it.
Sometimes yeah, I think
it's nice to just go and walk into the classroom, just close the door, and nobody can disturb you. And I have run a competition where my teachers weren't very good at tweeting. I mean, I think I need to rerun it this summer term as well. Where I said to them, whoever tweets the most, I'll put your name in the hat, and over the course of a half term, I'll pick a name in the hat, and I'll come teach your class for an afternoon, and you can go home. And tell you what, the tweeting went right up through the roof, and my year three teacher won, and I took my class for an afternoon.
That's nice. I like that. It's kind of killing two birds with one stone. It gets you back into the classroom, yeah. But also does wonders for staff morale as well.
Absolutely. Eh?
I think what you touch on there around being in touch with teaching as well, knowing what's going on in your classrooms is as important as actually getting in there and doing the teaching as well. But I do think that, you know, what you were saying there about taking year six booster groups, I think that when senior leaders do go into class, I think taking something that is really high stakes also sends a really important message to everybody as well around this idea of accountability. And I've talked before with Paul Klein when we had our conversation about instructional coaching. And we were talking about this idea of accountability. And initially, accountability, you know, when the phrase was kind of first coined, it was about a relationship and about everybody having something to give, everybody having some weight to put behind collective aims that teams have, and the idea being that as the leader, if you take the most vulnerable group or you take the most high stakes piece of teaching and you put your neck on the block to do that, it sends a really powerful message to everybody else that actually the leader's doing their bit. They're chipping in and doing what they said they were going to do. So there's no reason why we shouldn't all do exactly the same thing. So I do think that, you know, when you do go into class, being strategic about which classes you teach and why, and making sure that people know your why, is really important. And I think you touched on that as well there, where you talk about you're covering your year three teacher there. Everybody knows that that's as a result of this competition that you ran. But ultimately, there's a lovely kind of well-being undertone to that as well. And again, I think being in an environment that does demand the absolute highest of standards, which I know you do, having that undertone as well is so influential. Okay, so another question that came in, which I loved because it's just a really big question that's impossible to answer in like all of the time that we had tonight, let alone just a few minutes. But we're going to put you on the spot and see if you can do it anyway. Is the extra accountability worth it?
Oh, 100% yes. And yeah, it absolutely comes with the challenge, a huge amount of challenge. But it's also the opportunity to make a huge difference in the whole community and overall success of the school and the community. I mean, talking about all the stakeholders. So, yes, for me it is. And it comes back, I think we started this conversation with our why, really rooted deep down because, you know, it's, you know, heavy is the head that weighs, you know, the crown, they say. But if you know your why and it's your why is strong, and I think there's no one in headship who goes in it if they don't know their why, or in fact teaching, to be honest, because it's not, you know, we don't go this into Definitely. This job for the money. So I think, you know, all our whys are really strong. I think in the right environment, the accountability is absolutely worth it. You've got to find your clan, your people, your village, shall I say. Because some organisations are toxic. Some, I found myself fortunate in a wonderful one where, like I said, I'm left to, yes, I'm part of an academy trust and I've got that wider support from the MAT, but I'm also trusted to push my school in the direction I want to push. So there's that nice balance. So I'm not left entirely to my own devices, but I'm also not put upon constantly. So there's a nice balance where I still feel as part of the team, as part of the wider Inspire partnership, and very much, you know, working within the organisation as a team. We know our one trust approach, but also they understand really well that the schools need something different, you know, individually, and the heads can drive those individual things without, you know, yeah, within a shared framework.
It's interesting. I mean, you mentioned earlier that's obviously year six SATs week this week as well. And I have the same conversation with year six every year before their SATs, which is around this idea of anxiety and nerves. And I always say to them that the difference, as I see it, and this is, there's nothing scientific or research based in this at all, but as I see it, the difference between anxiety and nerves is that often anxiety is something that has really negative connotations. So it's basically when you're looking to try and sort of survive something, and the best you can hope for is just survival. Whereas nerves, when you have nerves, that's when you have the opportunity to achieve something really great, something that you really, really want, and something that is better than what you currently have. And so I always explain to them that what they're feeling is at the beginning of that SATS week is nerves, because they've worked so hard up towards that point and they have this opportunity to achieve something really great, which is, and as you know, from a year six SATS point of view, I think it's really important that the achievement is in taking the test.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And doing your best, not in passing the test. But, you know, you have this opportunity to kind of get to the end of this week and go, yeah, I did it. I got all the way through to the end of year or to the end of the year six SATs, and I gave it my absolute best, and I approached those exams in a way that's going to stand me in really good stead going forward. That's the achievement. And because you've got that opportunity to achieve that, it's nerves that you're feeling rather than anxiety. And I think there are parallels with what you're talking about there around, you know, the accountability that you have as a head. That's worth taking on if the potential prize is big enough for you and is right for you. And for you, obviously, and you know, in the conversations that we've had in the past, I know that you're really, really clear, and it's come through really strongly in this conversation as well, around what your ethos is and what your vision is and the direction you want to take things. So for you, if you have the opportunity to shape a community in that image that you know is right for that community, because again, comes back to that beautiful idea about being the custodian of the community as well, and custodian of the school, that potential reward makes the accountability worthwhile. If you didn't have that particular reward, maybe it's a different type of reward, but if it's not that one that really means something to you, then perhaps it's not worth it. Would you agree?
I would 100% agree.
Excellent. It's always nice when people agree. Okay, so next question that we had, and this is one that I've read quite a lot on. I know you mentioned earlier, I just did want to come back to this just for listeners, and firstly to anyone that is listening and is interested by our conversation here, do feel free to keep on messaging or calling in with your questions or comments. But something that Swabra touched on earlier was about doing your master's in educational leadership. And I did exactly the same thing. I did an MA in Ed Leadership, and I'm now doing my MPQH. But I would absolutely agree that if you get the opportunity to do an MA, absolutely take it, because it is incredible. Like the learning you take from it is absolutely brilliant. So that was just a bit of advice for anybody out there that is thinking about moving into senior leadership at any point in the future. But something that is foundational to any MA in leadership and also to the MPQH is this idea about the head teacher's role in securing the best outcomes for pupils. So as you see it, how important are head teachers in securing the best outcomes? Because as you said, you're not teaching classes, not regularly anyway. So how important is the head teacher to the outcomes that young people get?
Oh, I think it's hugely, the head teachers are hugely important. They steer the team. They're in the driving seat and they're steering the direction in which the school, they're setting the tone, they're setting the culture of the school. So in terms of, you know, behaviour for learning, you know, because, you know, without behaviour, learning's not going to be happening in classrooms. And they decide kind of where to place the emphasis for the school. And I very much believe in terms of keeping the scorecard. Not only do I want my teachers in the classrooms to keep their own scorecard, but I also want that accountability so they know that I'm keeping the scorecard in terms of knowing exactly what those books look like. Really unpicking those question level analysis when we're looking at end of assessments and holding them to account. But also every decision a head teacher makes has a financial implication. So we make a decision in terms of resources, the resources being physical resources, but also staffing. We know where the staffing can go, who support staff, additional tutors, school-led tutoring money when schools had, you know, COVID came and, you know, got school-led tutoring money. And we're making all those decisions that ultimately have outcomes for children, but also comes to staff well-being. And I talked about the culture and the tone and the ethos, but, you know, with staff well-being, levels of sickness and absence and ensures that, you know, teachers are there in a place that they want to be, in a happy environment. You know, it's a safe environment that children can want to and are able to learn. So it's not a solo. I don't do it all by myself, but I definitely support the team and set that direction that enables ultimately those outcomes.
Yeah, I love that. And you know, I think what you've captured really nicely there is this idea that the head teacher has that strategic influence on the outcomes that pupils get. Something I do, I'm very heavily invested in instructional coaching, and we are at Birkbeck really heavily invested in it as well. And something, a diagram that I use quite a lot with teachers is this idea about, you know, you've got yourself in the middle, and then you've got the first concentric circle that is the stuff that you are in complete control of. And then you've got that next circle that is the stuff that you can influence, and your kind of job is to push that circle of influence as wide as you can, but always understand that on the outside of both of those circles sits stuff that you just cannot control. And I often think that for a head teacher, on the subject of teaching and learning and the outcomes that pupils get, there is an enormous amount that sits in that influence circle. Not much that sits in your direct control circle, perhaps like recruitment. I guess if you get recruitment right and you put a really good teacher in front of children, there's a kind of a direct impact that you've got there. That's potentially within your control. But everything else kind of sits in that influence bit, and understanding how to influence the quality of teaching and learning across your school and being a really learning-centered leader in that way is fundamental to successful leadership going forward, I think. And you've touched on a couple of really nice ways of doing that. So making sure that you're always keeping teaching and learning front and center for everybody in your organization by being invested in it yourself, because everything that people in a school see the head teacher do, or everything that a head teacher does in school, sends a signal to everybody else about what's important. And if you're in classrooms and you're taking an interest in teaching and learning conversations, you're telling everybody else teaching and learning is fundamentally the most important thing that goes on in this school, after safeguarding, of course. So yeah, I absolutely think you've hit the nail on the head there around the idea of being able to influence so much that goes on in a school that then has that direct impact on teaching and learning.
And I guess I think it's someone commented quite recently to me is that they felt that I knew the detail. I knew the detail of the children. They were asking me about data, and I would turn around and talk to them about children in terms of like, oh yeah, that's that so-and-so is this child and this is what's happening, this is what we've put in place. So yes, I can talk about the data, and yes, I know the numbers, but I also know the children behind those numbers and what we're doing for them.
Yeah, and that, like, knowing the story that sits behind the numbers, I think is something that's so easily missed for a head teacher. But being able to talk about individual children, again, if you think about what message that sends to the rest of the staff, it's knowing your children is important because I know them. So you know, you guys really, really should. And it's really important that you do. And we highly value that as well. I think another thing that head teachers can do as well is kind of I think quite often in schools you get this this push around compliance, particularly in the sort of in this field of teaching and learning. So I've been to schools earlier on this academic year where we're kind of going around and head teachers showing us around, and they're going, so we do cold calling here. And I know there's, you know, cold calling is the big debate on edgy Twitter at the moment. And I know that Tom Rogers has got a fantastic show coming up live on X after we finish here, where he's going to dive right into that. So hang on for that if you are interested in that particular debate. I'm not going to talk about the efficacy of cold calling and the rights and wrongs of it. But what I do want to say is that if you have an approach where a school leader goes, we do cold calling here, what you then say to all of your teachers is, every time you ask a question, I want cold calling to be the technique that you used. And what you then stop teachers doing is thinking about the context of that exact moment and deciding, right, for how everybody's feeling at this moment in time, for what I'm trying to achieve with this question, for the point in the learning sequence that we're at, for the purpose of the question that I'm asking, what is the best strategy and technique for me to use? You divorce them from all of that thinking and you go, we use cold calling. We're a cold calling school. So you take away any of that thinking. And I think what a head teacher can do is avoid setting that culture and actually going, we've got a set of principles that we build teaching and learning around. And whatever your principles are, that's kind of less important, I suppose. And lots of schools kind of adopt Rosenstein's principles, for example. And that's absolutely fine. But it's about setting a really shared understanding and a shared language that runs alongside that of what high quality teaching and learning is. There's loads and loads of models out there that people can choose from, or you can come up with your own as a head teacher. But I think the opportunity that a head teacher has in setting a really principle driven approach to teaching and learning is that they enable teachers to feel trusted to do the contextual thinking in their own classrooms. And when teachers do that and they feel safe to do it because they fully understand the principles under which they're making those decisions, because that's the consistent bit, then you get the really high quality teaching and learning happening in classrooms. And that, I think, is where head teachers can have the biggest influence around what actually goes on in classrooms.
I absolutely agree, just in terms of arming teachers with the tools so that in their toolkit they can pull upon, you know, X, Y, Z, like you said, cold calling or Kagan strategies that we use quite a lot, but which particular ones are going to be helpful in that time. But it's our job to ensure that they've got the tool and the skills to do so.
I remember, I won't labour this point too much, but I remember going to one particular school and I was watching a teacher, we were doing this learning walk and watching this teacher, and she asked this question. It was a really open-ended question where she wanted children to be sort of doing some quite in-depth thinking and really explaining their thought processes. And in that school, it was, we use mini whiteboards. Like, mini whiteboards is our thing. We've been working on mini whiteboards and using mini whiteboards. So dutifully, she said, right, write your answers on your mini whiteboards. And children start writing away, and she's kind of circulating, and then she goes, okay, show me. And everybody puts their mini whiteboards under their chins, like perfect compliance. That teacher by that point had to try and take in about 90 sentences in like a split second, and then make a judgment in that moment over, right, have all of these children understood this concept that I've been trying to teach them? Do I need to reteach it? Do I need to remodel just little bits of it? Are we ready to move on? And there was no way that they could have made that decision, because there was just too much information coming at them. And when I spoke to them afterwards, they acknowledged that. And they said, yeah, I found it really difficult to know whether I should move on or not, because I couldn't really take in that much information. And I felt under pressure to kind of move on and not kind of hang around reading what everybody had written for too long. But we've worked really hard on using mini whiteboards. And I think, again, when head teachers set a surface level expectation that I want to see mini whiteboards used in the classroom, the signal you're sending to teachers is that I don't care about the thinking you're doing. I want to see that surface level evidence going on in classrooms. And I think if a head can take that step back and go, actually, here are the principles, as I say, that I want you to engage with and think about. And if it's mini whiteboards, why is it mini whiteboards? If it's cold calling, why is that? If you're going to use paired talk with a scaffolded sentence stem to support the responses, why that? And I think that it's just really important that head teachers create structures and frameworks for thinking and talking about teaching and learning that facilitate and value the teacher's contextual expertise. So yeah, really, really good to hear that you kind of concur with that as well. Another question that I'm really interested to kind of get into is how are you navigating relationships between parents and staff? Because quite often, what parents want or what parents demand or think they're entitled to contradicts with the vested interests of staff. So particularly around things like well-being, there can often be some conflict between what parents want and what staff want. How do you manage that?
It's fostering that open communication and that mutual respect and really shared understanding, because at the root of it, we all want what's best for the children. We're here, the parents, you know, no parent wants their child to not succeed. So, you know, we all want children to succeed. So it's being partnership focused rather than problem focused, and just clarity of the why we do things and the expectations, and comes back to those building those relationships. And you can have, you know, those conversations where I think a lot of problems can be overcome by just listening, really, really listening to what parents have to say, and then making it clear, you know, why you've taken a certain approach, and for them to understand the ethos behind it all and the values behind it all. And in my experience, even if the message hasn't landed well with them eventually in the instant, because it's rooted in the values, they're not going to argue with those values, because the values of integrity, of respect, of honesty, of communication, of collaboration are universal. So I think you just have to root it back to that and just not be open to say to parents, you know, actually sometimes we put our hands up and we don't get things right, and we're a human being, and being open to that feedback and acting on feedback.
I think it comes back again to that that value of authenticity and openness. And I think you're right. If you get people talking and people feel heard, often they're far more likely to come and meet you halfway. And there is often a way that you can show that you can get both staff and parents when there are those disagreements and kind of, I wouldn't say conflicts, but where there are those tensions in terms of the two parties wanting different things. By you can get people to meet halfway if you get people to listen and hear each other as well. I think that's absolutely key.
Ultimately, we all want the same thing. We want our ultimate goal is, you know, what's right for the child. It's, you know, let's navigate how we get there, but we want the same thing.
Absolutely right. Okay, so before we plunge into the last section of our chat tonight, we're going to go and hear our final message from our sponsors and friends.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support headteachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
Okay, welcome back. So before we dive into our last few questions, Tom has just written in and said, and absolutely right, Tom, that it is really difficult in any context, just going back to this mini whiteboard idea, to think of looking at every single one of those mini whiteboards. And the idea is that, you know, you choose a range and go from there. Now, and yes, you're right, that it does build participation ratio and accountability as well. But I do think it also comes back to this idea of purpose. So like, what is the purpose of using a mini whiteboard to answer this particular question that you're posing? Why is it that you want children to use a mini whiteboard in that moment? And I think that matching that to the type of question that you're asking as well can really help in terms of that point that you make there around whether you can actually take in all of that information. I'll give you an example, which would be the use of multiple choice hinge questions. So if when we think about using multiple choice questions, they kind of have a bit of a bad reputation in education. In historically, they certainly have anyway. When I started teaching, it was like you'd never use a multiple choice question because it would just be a case of, well, they're just going to guess and get it right or get it wrong. It's not going to tell you anything. But actually, if you choose, obviously you write your correct answer in there, but if you choose and design your incorrect answers with the deliberate aim of exposing a misconception, so you choose, right, I'm going to have these three incorrect answers here, but each of those incorrect answers will expose a misconception that a child has, and I'm going to label these options A, B, C, D, and you go, right, everybody show me. You can quickly scan the room and go, right, how many A's? Because A, you know, let's say A is the right answer. You go, how many A's? Yeah, good. Okay, most of us have got that. How many B's? Okay, I've got four B's. Those four B's are likely to have this particular misconception because I've chosen that particular answer for B to deliberately expose that misconception if it exists. How many C's? Same thing. How many D's? So you're absolutely right. It is difficult to take in all of the information at once, but I think if you match the use of mini whiteboards to the particular type of question that you're asking, I think you don't have to take in all of the information at the same time. You can kind of do it in staggers in that way. And you make a brilliant point as well, Tom, that the consistency of routines helps the students. Students moving from one class to the next, knowing what to expect and knowing how to use those routines is really important. But we've got to make sure that there's that range of routines as well. So children know how to work with cold call. They know how to work with think, pair, share. They know how to work with mini whiteboards and the full range of strategies across all of those different areas of teaching and learning. But yeah, a brilliant point, Tom. Thanks so much for making that. Okay, Swabru, I really want to get into diversity and this issue of diversity in leadership. But so just briefly, because I think this question is also one that's definitely worth asking. Can you just tell us your top three mistakes that you made when you started, or three things that you really wish you'd known before you started as a head teacher? And then we'll save some time at the end to get into this diversity issue, because I think it is so central.
Okay, top three things. I guess assuming that strategies are in more embedded than they are, so don't make any assumptions whatsoever. Communicating expectations clearly. I think earlier in a conversation I talked about that transitions around the schools and examples. That came from making a mistake that people knew exactly what I meant by, you know, we transition in silence. But being really, really explicitly clear what the expectations, the why behind them, to get that total buy-in from staff and from children. And I guess my third one will be not prioritising self-care and that work-life balance. There's always work to do as a head, so you have to just, you know, really prioritize. So I do not do any work when I get home on Friday night and Saturday. I'll do some work on Sunday just to prepare for the week, just for my agendas, etc. But I absolutely just one day a week not do any work, one day a week leave school early. Prime example today, I wanted to do this call from home, you know, left school by 4:30. So really prioritizing that balance. And just like I wake up at 5 or work, I do my exercise because I get too tired if I could do it in the evening. And it just makes me feel I'm set for the day because I've prioritized, you know, eating well, sleeping well. I'm a better leader on sleep and food.
Sleep, food, exercise.
Yes.
And then you can do the job.
Exactly. Then I'm far, far better at my job. I can think clearly.
Absolutely, because burnout's real, you know, it happens to the best of us. And unless you do prioritize those things that are going to put you in that mind space where you're able to deal with the intense, firstly, the intense challenge of the day, but also like the cognitive demand of being a school leader.
Yeah.
I did a little experiment not long ago, actually, where this was just before our new head teacher started, and she's taken lots of the load off me. But I had like my phone next to me for the day on my stopwatch, and I timed how long I had in between each, I'm going to say, interruption. That's, you know, often you know you want to be interrupted, you want people to come and feel they can talk to you, but I timed how long it was between each exchange that I had with the next member of staff. The longest period of uninterrupted time that I had over the course of the whole day was 8.5 minutes.
Wow.
That's crazy.
I'm going to try that.
It's so interesting.
That. Yeah. But I also find that those interruptions are the work, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Absolutely. And that in no way, you know, I'm in no way suggesting that people should leave you alone in your office. But what it does mean is that you, if you are going to, if you need that strategic thinking time, and we all do, you've got to ring fence that and go, right, you know, this next hour and a half, this I am thinking strategically. I'm having that time to think on this particular thing. So I'm not going to take any other exchanges in that time. And then, the rest of the time.
A set of headphones on a laptop, it looks like you're on a Zoom meeting. Just for 20 minutes, half an hour.
Put the headphones in.
the staff looking, oh, she's on a call. I don't do it often. And if they're listening now, they know.
yeah, that's it. You're rumbled now. God. Absolutely. Okay. So we've got kind of 6 or 7 minutes left, and I didn't want to let this call finish without talking to you about diversity, because I know it's something that is incredibly important to you. Diversity in leadership. It's something that's incredibly important to me as well. My son is mixed heritage. And so it's always been something that, you know, the idea of him having real models that he can see himself in when he goes to school, particularly in leadership positions, is really, really important to me. And I know it's something that's super important to you as well. Do you just want to tell us how important it is to you and why?
Oh, it's hugely important. Why? Because I happen to be a Kenyan-born Muslim black woman living in the UK. I think I read a stat not long ago that there was, 31 black male head teachers in the country, and 0.1% of leaders in headship level are black females. When you look at the deputy level, there's a lot more. But it's not just about statistics and about numbers, but it's just really understanding that we bring a different point of view and a different way of seeing things, a different lens, and it just enriches the conversations that we have. I am fortunate to work in a really diverse, very, very drastically different to Birkbeck, where I was the only black member of staff. There was a dinner lady, and I had parents refusing to deal with me because I happened to be the black deputy head. And that was a very unique experience at Birkbeck, because I hadn't experienced that at all. I was so fortunate in my teaching experience has been so richly, diversely different in everywhere I've worked. So when I came to Birkbeck, it was a real shock to me. I was like, oh, right, okay. I've not experienced this before. Mm. And I've landed in a school and an organisation where we are hugely diverse, and we are unapologetically diverse in terms of our curriculum, and we've got our own kind of global curriculum that is reflecting our children. The majority of my school, my staff is hugely diverse, my children are hugely diverse, and it's children being able to, you can't be what you can't see. I know that's in a kind of overused saying, but it really does matter. But it also means that we can really understand and the experiences of others. So just example, my school, we've got a huge Muslim population, so a third of the school is Muslim. We've got a multi-faith prayer room, and my deputy head is so, like, she's so proud of herself. She's like, the boys will come in to do their prayers, and she knows exactly, just because from our conversations with each other in terms of the prayer and the ritual wash in Islam. And she said, oh, I didn't know this. I didn't know where to find, even though I've taught this, living it and seeing it and be able to relate to these children. So it's not just me relating to them because I share a faith with them, but now my wider team can relate to them because they share that understanding with them and that respect with them. I think it fosters that sense of belonging. You don't have to be. So whether I'm there or I'm not, that sense of belonging, because my deputy head, who's white, and my rest of the team, the boys know that they belong because they understand their culture and understand, what's important with parents. So I think it just enriches all our lives. It really, really does.
And I think that's so important as well. And I know you said that your current setting is far more diverse than previous settings as well. But I think that it's often as important in some ways that settings that are less diverse have that big focus within the curriculum. Otherwise, where do these children learn about the importance of diversity? And I know in the curriculum that we did some work on the curriculum at Birkbeck when I started there, and one of the units of work that we looked at really, really closely was a unit of work that they do in year two, and they study Florence Nightingale and Mary Seacole, but we also wrote Rafia Al-Aslamaya into that unit of work as well. And for anybody that doesn't know, she was a Muslim nurse that lived about 1,000 years earlier than Florence Nightingale and Mary Seacole, and hugely, hugely influential person. And we think probably the earliest recorded example of someone training other people to be nurses. But you don't hear anything about her, and very little about her is actually written. And there's certainly there's very little kind of visual representation, visual image of her. And so it was really important to us that we wrote her into our curriculum and gave her that kind of rightful place that she deserves. And I remember doing an assembly on her to our key stage one children. And there was a little boy at the front, and he was sat next to a girl in his class who was also Muslim. And I was talking about Rafida al-Islamiyah, and he turned completely spontaneously, turned to this girl next to him and just went, "Wow, you're Muslim. That's amazing." And you just think, that's why we've got to do it, so that the perceptions of diversity that all of these children hold are transformed, and we make sure that they're positive, because then those children are going to go home, and if they are exposed to negative views of around diversity, they're going to challenge it, and if they challenge it, then gradually, generation upon generation, we weed it
absolutely
out.
Absolutely, it's that, you know, that otherness, you know, getting away from that otherness. We are all one, and it's only by understanding each other's histories and, you know, points of views and cultures that we can, you know, enriching our tapestry.
Indeed. Swabra, this has been an absolute joy of a conversation. I've had an amazing time talking to you about all things headship. And I've often wanted to have this conversation with you, actually, ever since you left Birkbeck and I took over from your deputy role. It's always been a conversation I've wanted to have, and hopefully we can go into more detail on it another time as well. It'd be great to pick up on some of these points again in the future.
I'd love to come back. Thank you so much for having me.
Good stuff. So listeners, if you are sticking around on Teachers Talk Radio tonight, I would highly, highly recommend it. Tom Rogers is about to go live on X talking all about cold calling. So it is the thing of the moment. Lots and lots of debate around cold calling at the moment on social media, and Tom is going to get into the details of that. So do stick around for that. And other than that, I will see you and hear you hopefully next week on the Monday Twilight Show with me, Adam Colbeck, when we'll have another guest and another interesting topic to explore. Have a lovely evening and enjoy the rest of your week.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.